Information is free.
The law? Yeah.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care.
Here to border
it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nine you have seen.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Sun cycles or global warming, I'm not sure, but it's a hot one. And it's Media Monarchy, episode 87. It's August 15th, 2008. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, and RevereRadio.info. It's a lot. Assassinations, shrooms, cyanide, watch list, GOP anarchy, NYC, Sentinel, fabled enemies, Gardasil, martial law, Arkansas, NRA mole, Olympic deaths, and TV fakery, Russia, Georgia, Ford informant, WV beast, Edwards, Grove, anthrax, more and more and more. It's August 15th, 2008, episode 87 of MediaMonarchy.com.
Yeah! I'm gonna make love, even when I'm dead. My body might get cold, but it's always hot in my bed. Make love, don't be afraid. Just because my heart ain't beating, don't mean it won't get laid.
Chef, he's gone off to the big super adventure club in the sky, and that's not very respectful, but Isaac Hayes has passed away, so there's a little bit of South Park chef thriller action for you. Welcome aboard, my friends. Like I said, episode 87, August 15th, 2008, MediaMonarchy.com. That's all the music I got time for you, because it's going to be an ugly, brutal, jam-packed show. Coming to you live, as always, Friday mornings at 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, and Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time, RevereRadio.info. You can also hear it on 95.3 in Boulder and 87.9 in Atlanta. And, of course, MySpace, Dig, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, Skype, Twitter, all with Media Monarchy as your keyword. iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org is where you get and share the podcast anytime, all the time. So yeah, it's a hot one. I think it's going to be 100 today here in Portland, Oregon. It was not in the brochure, but I'll deal with it somehow. I want to say thanks to those who sent me some birthday love this last week. I appreciate it. And like I said, you can hit me up on IM, trying to leave it on more. And thanks to folks like Hate Filters for hitting me up on IM. But let's do it. Let's get into it. All the news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups right here on MediaMonarchy.com. Top of the page right now, Russia says Poland risks attack due to U.S. missiles. This from the Associated Press. An agreement that will allow the U.S. to install a missile defense battery in Poland exposes the ex-communist nation to an attack, a Russian general said Friday. Poland and the United States struck a deal on Thursday to deepen military ties and place a missile interceptor base in Poland. General Anatoly Nogofitsyn, deputy chief of the Russian General Staff, told reporters Friday that the agreement exacerbates U.S.-Russian relations that are already tense because of fighting between Georgian and Russian forces. He said the deal, quote, cannot go unpunished. And, of course, we're going to get into the U.S.-Russia proxy war through Georgia. I need to learn to pop open a news window while I'm doing the show, because I swear there are a lot of times I'm here doing the show and something big breaks and I don't find out till I get home, and I could have broken it for you first. Like last week, John Edwards' love affair and, of course, the U.S.-Russia proxy war with Georgia. And we're going to get into all that. We've also got a key Clinton ally killed at the Arkansas Democratic headquarters. And there are links. You can hit up the regular reports from places like Raw Story. But there's something written from my man Webster Tarpley. Is the death of an Arkansas Democratic Party chairman part of an Obama body count? Arkansas Democratic Party chairman Bill Guatney fell victim to what was evidently a political assassination. Guatney was a major ally of Hill and Bill Clinton and was a leader of the strongly pro-Clinton Arkansas delegation to the upcoming Denver Democratic National Convention. Guatney's Arkansas delegation was known to be a hotbed of anti-Obama sentiment and was reportedly ready to walk out of the Denver convention if Senator Clinton were not to be treated fairly by the Howard Dean Donna Brazile DNC leadership. Observers in Washington are now asking whether the assassination of Guatney can be read as an attempted intimidation of the anti-Obama forces which are now gaining strength before the Denver convention. Is the death of Bill Guatney part of an Obama body count, which already includes the names of Donald Young, the murdered gay choir master of Reverend Wright's church, and possibly others?
About 11:49, we received a call to a shooting at the Democratic Party headquarters on Capitol Avenue. According to the witnesses there, a white male. We do not have a complete confirmation on him. We have an ID we're working on, but we will not be releasing his name at this time. Walked into the headquarters, asked for Chairman Guatney to the secretary. She turned around and spoke with Mr. Guatney in the office. He walked around, an employee walked in, did meet Mr. Guatney. They introduced themselves. At that time, he pulled out a handgun and shot Chairman Guatney several times. He then turned and left the business.
And he walked on down the hall. So we'll see what comes of that story as we maybe find more out. And there are links there. You can follow it. But we got to move on. A few miscellaneous messes of news posted up. First one, bullets, bombs, Benazir, FB spy, quarantines, drugs, and Hitler. So first we have, yet again from the Associated Press, bullet shortage affects police, a nationwide spike in demand for small arms ammunition, and the skyrocketing cost of raw materials to make the bullets have forced some law enforcement agencies in Washington state to plan their orders further in advance. On average, the cost of ammunition has increased by 67% between 2004 and now, according to the GAO, or that's not true, the General Administration Office, which negotiates contracts with suppliers for state and local agencies. The woes in Washington state are part of a shortage that has strained law enforcement nationwide. Now, of course, you can bet that if law enforcement is having trouble keeping up with ammo, then the public will as well. If we jump now to winterpatriot.blogspot.com, he's got an update on the ridiculous alleged liquid bombing plot, ludicrouser and ludicrouser, alleged liquid bombing plot revisited again. In the UK, the prosecution has laid out its case against the alleged terrorist plotters who have come to be known as the liquid bombers, and it's much different than the stories that were leaked just after the suspects were arrested 2 years ago this weekend. Those stories sparked considerable interest at Winter Patriot, where chemistry is no barrier. And the previous leaked versions of the alleged plot were utterly preposterous, as I've pointed out several times since they were leaked, with links to all the background stories there. But the new alleged plot, the one testified to in court by British authorities, is even more ludicrous than the alleged plots in any of the previously leaked stories. The technical difficulties inherent in the new alleged plot have been hinted at just barely in mainstream media reports, such as one from the New York Times and reporter Elaine Scolino, as published in the Seattle Times. And so, again, I believe I mentioned it last week as I was ranting about going through the airport and watching them throw people's liquids away that are more than 3.5 ounces. Those patsies didn't have tickets, didn't have passports, didn't have the materials. And even if they had all those things, cooking up what they said they were going to cook up in an airplane bathroom was pretty much going to be impossible. Now to think progress. U.S. intel agencies tapped Benazir Bhutto's phone. In his new book, The Way of the World, which we discussed last week, where he disclosed that the White House has a little secret interrogation room, and also that the White House was behind the fake CIA documents trying to leak, or rather link, Iraq and 9/11. However, another one, out of the way of the world, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskin reveals that Vice President Darth Cheney repeatedly backed Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf over former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, who was assassinated in December. According to Suskin, the State Department strongly backed Bhutto's return to Pakistan, but Cheney opposed it, considering her, quote, complicated and unpredictable. Bhutto regretted that Cheney refused to pressure Musharraf to behave and instead kept pressuring her to reconcile with him. U.S. intel agencies also reportedly intercepted Bhutto's phone calls, quote, for months, including a call made to her son. And you can hit PacTribune.com for more on that. And of course, as we mentioned, Pervez Musharraf, we're going to get a little bit about him. Hopefully, I think I had a better birthday than him. Me and Pervez share a birthday on August 11th. But anyway, let's jump to the aforementioned New York Times. More interception. FBI says it obtained reporters' phone records. The FBI said last Friday that it had improperly obtained the phone records of reporters for the New York Times and the Washington Post in the newspaper's Indonesia bureaus in 2004. Robert Mueller, director of the FBI, disclosed the episode in a phone call to Bill Keller, the executive editor of the Times, and apologized for it. He also spoke with Leonard Downey Jr., the executive editor of the Washington Post, to also apologize to him. FBI officials said the incident came to light as part of the continuing review by the Justice Department Inspector General's office into the Bureau's improper collection of telephone records through emergency records demands issued to phone providers. The records were apparently sought as part of a terrorism investigation, but the FBI did not explain what was being investigated or why the reporters' phone records were considered relevant. They don't have to explain. All you have to do is say it's an emergency. And you get your Enabling Act, or your Patriot Act, or your FISA Act, or whatever it is. Naturalnews.com has an article, U.S. cities would be locked down and quarantined under pandemic flu response plan. The federal government would need to quarantine infected households and ban public gatherings to contain a pandemic flu, according to a computer simulation study conducted by researchers from Virginia Tech and published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, PNAS. And there's a link there, and you can read their whole massive scientific study, the abstract and the full PDFs and all that. Quote, you wouldn't go out to the movies, you wouldn't congregate with people, said researcher Stephen Eubank. You'd pretty much be staying home with the doors and windows battened down. The consensus among health experts is that a pandemic or global epidemic of influenza is inevitable. The last such pandemic in 1918 killed between 40 and 100 million people. And if you'd like to hit that link right there, you can read, if we jump back to October of last year, how there's a flu lab set up, and they're going to reconstruct the 1918 flu. And as we've gone over, whether it's Plum Island or Porton Down or Fort Detrick, it's bad news. But good news, and as Bill Hicks would call a positive drug story, we can hit up The Guardian. clinical trials test potential of hallucinogenic drugs to help patients with terminal illnesses. Scientists are exploring the use of psychedelic drugs such as LSD to treat a range of ailments from depression to cluster headaches and obsessive compulsive disorder. The first clinical trial using LSD since the 70s began in Switzerland in June. It aims to use psychedelic psychotherapy to help patients with terminal illnesses come to terms with their imminent mortality and so improve their quality of life.
Well, there's been this sort of resurgence in interest in psychedelic drugs for treating a range of things from sort of depression to cluster headaches and obsessive compulsive disorder. And like any clinical trial, because these are rigorous scientific clinical trials, they're not peaceniks messing around. These are serious scientists really trying to get to the bottom of what they can use these drugs for. And like any clinical trial, essentially you have a group of patients who are receiving the drug and a group of patients who are receiving the control. Now, unlike most drug treatments where you would just give a sugar pill as the control, in this case, if you did that, it would be quite obvious to everyone who had had the drug and who hadn't. And so what they do is they give two different sizes of dose. Either you get a massive dose, which gives you a pretty intense experience, I would imagine, and a small dose, which gives you a flavor of the experience, but not as intense. And so you would expect, if the drug is doing something useful, that those people who've had the big dose get a better effect. And of course, when the trial's going on, the patients themselves and the doctors who are overseeing the trial don't know which, you know, it's a double-blind trial, so they don't know who has which dose until after.
Psychedelic psychotherapy is what they want to give me. If we jump now to Javno, J-A-V-N-O, but I got it from Alex Constantine. blogspot.com. Hitler's relatives found happiness in Israel. The descendants of war criminals are often marked by the sins of their ancestors. We can find examples of that across the globe and throughout human history. Somewhat more rare are cases of descendants who decided to flee from the past by running off to the descendants of the victims of their ancestors. A reporter of The Guardian, Tanny Gold, discovered this paradox after reading a magazine for Orthodox Jews. The son of a notorious SS officer converted to Judaism and moved to Israel, where he served the army. She also found dozens of such examples, so she traveled to Israel to find out what exactly made them make such a change in their lives. And if you go on through that article, it details how one of Hitler's relatives found happiness in Israel. And if we jump to another cluster of news, this one called Mind Drugs, Tom Clancy, Deniable Laser, Invisibility, and Control. This is all a little bit on the police state MilTech tip. First up from Telegraph, Future Wars to be Fought with Mind Drugs. Landmines releasing brain-altering chemicals, scanners reading soldiers' minds, and devices boosting eyesight and hearing could all one day figure in arsenals, suggests a study. Sophisticated drugs designed for dementia patients, but also allowing troops to stay awake and alert for several days, are expected to be developed. It is thought that some U.S. soldiers are already taking drugs prescribed for narcolepsy in an attempt to combat fatigue, as well as those physically and mentally boosting one's own troops. Substances could also be developed to deplete an opponent's forces. So, much like eugenics, you can have positive eugenics, or you could have negative eugenics. So you can have positive mind drugs or negative mind drugs. Off next to truthnews.us, and I only have just a little bit of this, but the article goes further into it. Tom Clancy's Predictive Programming, Ghost Recon, and the Georgia-Russian War. Did Tom Clancy's lucky assertions foretell in 2001 the Georgia conflict of 2008 and foretell in 2004 the Security and Prosperity Partnership, the SPP? We will analyze Clancy's seemingly clairvoyant references about the ongoing conflict in Georgia, which include the following lucky assertions. 1. Civil unrest in Russia in August 2008. 2. U.S. clandestine support of rebel factions in Georgia. 3. Specifically cites South Ossetia War in 2008. 4. The U.S. clandestine forces, ghosts, are deployed in Ossetia to silence the rebellion. 5. U.S. ghosts battle South Ossetian rebel forces from the north of Georgia. 6. Russian government eventually sends in their army to aid the South Ossetian rebels.
And it goes on to also detail the SPP and the coming North American Union. Next, from New Scientist, U.S. boasts of laser weapons' plausible deniability. An airborne laser weapon dubbed the, quote, long-range blowtorch, and there's actually a PDF that you can check out more, has the added benefit that the U.S. could convincingly deny any involvement with the destruction it causes, say senior officials of the U.S. Air Force. The Advanced Tactical Laser, ATL, is to be mounted on a Hercules military transport plane. Boeing announced the first test firing of the laser from a plane on the ground earlier this summer. Cynthia Kaiser, chief engineer of the U.S. Air Force Research Laboratory's Directed Energy Directorate, used the phrase plausible deniability to describe the weapon's benefits in a briefing, and you can hit up her PowerPoint presentation. So she described the weapon's benefits in a briefing on laser weapons to the New Mexico Optics Industry Association in June. And you can hit the link and read about plausible deniability. Key phrase from back in the CIA, and of course, the title of Mark Lane's follow-up to Rush to Judgment, Plausible Denial, about the CIA's involvement in the assassination of JFK. Up next to the AFP, French agency press, invisibility cloak now within sight. Haha. The age-old fantasy of making yourself invisible is taking a step toward reality, with scientists saying they have created three-dimensional materials that can bend visible light. For the moment, the Vanishing Act takes place on a nanoscale measured in billionths of a meter. But there's no fundamental reason why the same principles cannot be scaled up one day to make invisibility cloaks big enough to hide a person, a tank, or even a tanker. The groundbreaking experiments led by folks at the University of California at Berkeley were reported simultaneously last Sunday in the British journal Nature and the U.S.-based journal Science. Finally, again, Scientific American, mind control by cell phone, and rather, again, from Alex Constantine, not again, from Scientific American. This was a completely unexpected finding. We didn't suspect any effect on EEG after switching off the phone. We were interested in studying the effect of mobile phone signals on sleep itself. But it quickly became obvious to Horn and colleagues in preparing for the sleep research experiments that some of the test subjects had difficulty falling asleep. Horn and his colleagues controlled a Nokia 6310E cell phone, another popular basic phone, attached to the head of 10 healthy but sleep-deprived men in their research lab. Sleep research lab. The experiment revealed that after the phone was switched to talk mode, a different brainwave pattern called delta waves in the range of 1 to 4 hertz remained dampened for nearly 1 hour after the phone was shut off. Although the test subjects had been sleep deprived the night before, they could not fall asleep for nearly 1 hour after the phone had been operating without their knowledge. Although this research shows that cell phone transmissions can affect a person's brainwaves with persistent effects on behavior, Horn does not feel there's any need for concern that cell phones are damaging. They'll just give you tumors on the side of your head, and they can control your sleep at the very least, but don't worry. And of course, now we return to Denver, the hotbed of PSYOP activity leading up to the Democratic National Convention in just about 10 days from now. Cyanide PSYOP in the coming Denver convention. So we've got stuff from the AP as well as Kurt Nimmo and several other links buried within this story. So first from the AP, pound of cyanide found in room where man died. About a pound of highly toxic sodium cyanide was found in a hotel room where a man's body was discovered. The Denver medical examiner was still awaiting test results to determine what killed Saliman Abdirahman Diri. And I believe in the clip I'm going to play, they may pronounce that a little better than I just did. Police said they do not suspect foul play. And the FBI said there was no apparent connection to terrorism. Deary's body was found Monday in the Burnsley All Suite Hotel. Investigators said he had been dead for several days. to which I saw a comment that said, damn, they need to clean their rooms more often. Fire officials said they found a bottle of the white powder in Deary's room. Police said Wednesday that it was, in fact, cyanide.
The Denver Police Crime Lab is testing that substance. It could be a few days before we know exactly what it is. But nothing in this case links to terrorism at this point, nor does it link to the upcoming Democratic National Convention. But this investigation is far from over. At this point, the FBI will not confirm it's cyanide, but it's ramping up the investigation by bringing in specialized agents.
Our Joint Terrorism Task Force is involved in this simply because it's the victim here is from another country, and it just kind of makes sense that our terrorism guys would take a look at this.
One guy that knows cyanide.
It's poisonous.
It's Dr. Andrew Turney.
I don't see how anybody could do anything but look into the possibility that this is a potential terrorist attack.
Dr. Turney has worked with the U.S. Department of Defense for 25 years. He's published textbooks and written The Language of Nightmares, a glossary of all things deadly, including cyanide.
So if somebody says, oh my God, I've just gotten exposed to something, whatever it is.
It's Dr. Turney who develops a drug to counteract the poison. So when he learned of the discovery of a container with what might be cyanide at the Burnsley Hotel,
the very first thought that came to my mind was murder or somebody who's got to kill an awful lot of rodents. Because years ago, cyanide used to be used to kill rats.
So how much cyanide does it take to kill?
A tablespoon would be enough to kill you. Less, actually.
It's why this investigation continues.
Cyanide PSYOP. And so, like I said, there's articles posted up there, also from Kurt Nimmo. False flag cyanide attack planned for the DNC? Question mark. Is it possible anarchists or other terrorists, specifically Muslims who hate us for our freedoms, will disrupt the DNC with a cloud of cyanide gas? It appears the corporate media is preparing us for some sort of terrorist event during the convention. And as a nice little follow-up to that, from the IANS news service, official says Al-Qaeda may attack during U.S. election season. A top U.S. counterterrorism official has warned of a heightened risk of an Al-Qaeda attack during the upcoming U.S. election, with the terrorist outfit exploiting recent political turmoil in Pakistan to strengthen its sanctuary there. While intelligence officials are unaware of specific plans for attacks inside the U.S., they expect an increase in threats in the run-up to the U.S. elections. Ted Gistaro, G-I-S-T-A-R-O, the National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats, has claimed in an assessment. So, boogie boogie, Al-CIA is going to get you. Now, of course, we have to have our first bit of 9/11 news, of which there will be much more to follow. But two, first from the AP, a federal appeals court has ruled, with a link to the PDF, and you can see their ruling, that Saudi Arabia and four of its princes cannot be held liable in the 9/11 attacks. The appeals court issued the ruling Thursday, saying the Saudi defendants are protected by sovereign immunity. It also agreed with a lower court that a Saudi banker and a charitable organization cannot be held liable. The Saudi defendants were among hundreds of other defendants sued by victims of the attacks, including the families of those who died. Other defendants in the case include foreign governments, charities, and individuals alleged to have provided financial and logistical support to Al-Qaeda. But on a positive note, I've mentioned the New York 9/11 ballot referendum. So this from Gothamist, fortunately covering the story. Ed Asner wants ballot referendum for new 9/11 probe. Watch your back, Dick. Actor Ed Asner, former Dallas Cowboy Mark Stepnoski, and formerly famous hip-hop group Arrested Development are leading a petition drive to get a referendum on New York City's November ballot that would establish a new 9/11 investigation. And you can go to nyc911initiative.org, nyc911initiative.org, if the group, called 9/11 Truth, can collect 30,000 signatures before September 4th, the City Council will be required to consider the measure, which calls for an investigative panel featuring folks like Mike Gravel, former Senator Lincoln Chafee, Ed Asner, and Jersey Girl and 9/11 widow Lori Van Auken. And they tell New York Magazine that, quote, the original commission didn't get to the bottom of anything. We need to investigate from scratch. Now moving to Raw Story and Raw Replay and CNN and the TSA and watch lists and on, author critical of Bush, he found himself on the watch list.
An author says he was put on the terror watch list shortly after writing a book that was critical of President Bush. Well, that story sounded all too familiar to our special investigation unit's Drew Griffin. Drew also found himself on the watch list shortly after a series of reports critical of the TSA. Drew joins me now this morning from Atlanta. So is this terror watch list, and you're wondering this now, being used as a way to inconvenience political enemies?
You know, Kieran, it sounds like a kooky conspiracy theory. Until you find yourself trying to figure out why your common American name is linked in anyway to terrorism, like the guy you're about to meet, a Texan named Jim Moore.
You said he understood.
It's a little disturbing.
He has written three books about President Bush, all critical, and his toughest, Bush's War for Re-Election.
And that book was released right after Labor Day in 2004, and that started the entire national controversy over George W. Bush and the National Guard.
Moore's research into the President's National Guard service dogged the Bush re-election campaign in the fall of 2004.
I accept your nomination for President.
After George Bush won re-election in November, Moore decided to go on vacation. It was January, and it was his first flight since that election. And something was wrong. He couldn't check in at home, couldn't check in at a kiosk. Went to the ticket counter and found out why.
All of a sudden, I find myself on the no-fly watch or selectee list, and traveling became very, very complicated.
According to the ACLU, his name is one of a million names and aliases that have a match on the so-called terror watch list. When Moore called the TSA, as directed by the airline, he says a TSA employee told him he'd just have to put up with it.
And she said, the only thing I can tell you, Mr. Moore, is that there is something in your background which is similar to someone they're looking for.
Do you buy it?
No, of course not.
Something similar to someone somewhere. And we, of course, in previous weeks have hit up CNN's Drew Griffin, also being on the terrorist TSA watch list. Returning to the Associated Press, Julia Child was an OSS spy. Famed chef Julia Child shared a secret with Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg and Chicago White Sox catcher Mo Berg at a time when the Nazis threatened the world. They served in an international spy ring managed by the Office of Strategic Services, an early version of the CIA created in World War II by President Franklin Roosevelt. The secret came out yesterday, Thursday. All the names in previously classified files identifying nearly 24,000 spies who formed the first centralized intelligence effort by the United States. The National Archives, which this week released a list of the names found in the records, will make available for the first time all 750,000 pages identifying the vast spy network of military and civilian operatives. You can hit up the National Archives at archives.org and also have the link over to at least their press release for the release. I'm not sure if those will be available in any kind of text form or if you actually have to go to the archives in D.C. and check them out. Returning to Raw Replay and Raw Story, this from WCCO-TV out of St. Paul. Police preparing for anarchy at GOP convention. WCCO-TV has obtained several internal police documents documenting the possible tactics of the radical groups that may try to disrupt the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. Some law enforcement groups are calling for more police. More police!
The Republican National Convention is less than 3 weeks away now, and police are planning on thousands of visitors to the Twin Cities.
Several anarchists and anti-authority groups claim they want to disrupt or possibly shut down the convention. WCCO obtained internal police documents that show just how some visitors hope to cause chaos. Here's Frank Vassalero.
Controlling a crowd during a mass legal protest like this one at the Republican National Convention in New York City 4 years ago brings special challenges for police. But a group bent on destruction, like these protesters at the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, present an entirely different security concern. WCCO has obtained several internal police documents documenting the possible tactics of the more radical groups that may try to disrupt the convention in St. Paul. Police estimate anywhere from 700 to 1,200 anarchist or anti-authoritarian protesters may be in the Twin Cities for a convention. Two people concealing their identities, using fake names, and claiming to be part of an anarchist group recently appeared on a Twin Cities program called Our World in Death. The program's on a website.
Are anarchists revolutionary? Do they believe in a revolution?
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope every anarchist has a goal of revolution. But
the internet is the clearinghouse for information. RNC Welcoming Committee and Unconventional Action are the prominent anti-authoritarian sites. One claims its goal is to organize militant direct action that manifests opposition to both the Democratic and Republican parties. According to the Internal Police Report, blockading the XL Energy Center will be the primary strategy of local anarchists. This police document shows how the anarchists may divide St. Paul in sectors around the convention center, with each group responsible for shutting down a specific area.
Violent, provocateur protests coming soon to a convention near you. Let's return now to the frightening Biolabs. Playing politics with Biolabs. This again from the AP, the Homeland Security Department. Homeland. Fatherland. Heartland. Homeland Security swept aside evaluations of government experts and named Mississippi, home to powerful U.S. lawmakers with sway over the agency, as a top location for a new $451 million national laboratory to study some of the world's most virulent biological threats. This all according to internal documents obtained by the AP. Mississippi's lawmakers include the Democratic chairman of the department's oversight committee in the House and the senior Republican on the Senate Appropriations Committee, which is expected to approve money to build the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility. And there's the Homeland Security press release for you. They're going to build the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility at one of five sites being considered. The two lawmakers said they were unaware of the Homeland Security evaluation system that scored the Mississippi site so low. The disclosure is the latest example of what critics assert is the Bush administration's politicizing of government decisions, such as efforts to steer science over global warming at the EPA and hiring and firing practices or malpractices at the Justice Department. Now, of course, we know it's not just the Bush administration. They're the birdcage liner. They will be removed. And God knows what we're going to get. But fortunately, good folks like CollateralNews.tv make weekly web news shows. Their new one, Collateral News, episode 54, is called Real Wars, Fake Triggers. What happens when the media doesn't report a proposal by the vice president's national security team to purposely kill Americans in order to provoke war with Iran? What happens is the proposal stands a better chance of becoming reality.
Every war needs an incident to trigger it. Some of these incidents are real, but many are fabricated. Take World War II, for instance.
In August of 1939, six German SS officers dressed as Polish freedom fighters broke into a German radio station.
The Gliwice incident, as it's become known, was the last in a series of staged incidents designed to justify war. It was immediately followed by a full-scale German attack against Poland.
Now, fast forward to Vietnam in 1964. A U.S. destroyer is in North Vietnamese waters trying to provoke an attack. Now, it's able to do so with one incident. But the second incident, the one that triggered the first large-scale U.S. engagement in Vietnam, never took place. Only 1 hour after the incident, the U.S. commander cabled back to Washington that it was nothing more than a false sonar reading. Now in 2008, the latest attempt to trigger a war via fabricated means comes from none other than Dick Cheney's office, according to Seymour Hersh. Welcome to Collateral.
There was
was a dozen ideas proffered how to trigger a war. The one that interested me the most was, why don't we build, we in our shipyard, build four or five Iranian boats that look like Iranian PT boats, put Navy SEALs on them with a lot of arms, and the next time one of our boats goes through the Straits of Hormuz, start a shoot-up. Might cost some lives. And it was rejected because you can't have Americans killing Americans. But that's the level of stuff we were talking about, provocation. But that was rejected.
This is a depraved idea. Now let's examine the reasons why it's not being covered appropriately.
I'm impressed here. Anyway, there was a meeting among the items considered and rejected, which is why the New Yorker did not publish it, on grounds that it wasn't accepted.
The stated reason for the New Yorker's refusal to publish this is demonstrably weak. First off, it's news that something like this would even be suggested, since carrying it out would be treasonous. And second, nobody on the New Yorker's editorial board or Seymour Hersh himself can say for sure that the proposal was in fact rejected. It was said to be rejected at the meeting in Cheney's office, but that assures nothing, of course.
Episode 54 of Collateral News, Real Wars, Fake Triggers. Now, of course, they don't use the phrase, but they pretty much detail some of the classic false flag attacks, like at the Gliwice radio station or the Gulf of Tonkin. Let's jump to another bit of unbelievable media. This coming from WCBS, NYPD's Operation Sentinel to track everything. The NYPD is working on a plan to track every single vehicle that enters Manhattan. The initiative, called Operation Sentinel, is aimed at preventing terror attacks. With the use of cameras and radiation sensors, police plan to track anything and everything that enters the Big Rotten Apple.
The NYPD is reportedly working on a plan to track every vehicle that enters Manhattan. Operation Sentinel is aimed at preventing terror attacks. CBS 2's Deborah Garcia has more live from Lower Manhattan. Deborah, good morning.
Good morning, Kate. That's right. Operation Sentinel is aimed at preventing another terror attack. With the use of cameras and radiation sensors, police reportedly plan to track anyone or anything suspicious entering Manhattan.
The New York Police Department reportedly wants to photograph the license plates of every vehicle coming into Manhattan and keep the image and information in a database. The plan is all part of Operation Sentinel and is detailed in today's New York Times. The proposal is part of a multi-million-dollar plan to secure Lower Manhattan. It includes cameras, license plate readers, and radiation detectors. They would be set up at 7 vehicle crossings, the Brooklyn Battery, Holland, Lincoln, and Queens Midtown Tunnels. Also, the George Washington, Henry Hudson, and Triborough Bridges, and also smaller bridges like the Willis Avenue and Macomb's Dam Bridges. It is unclear exactly when Operation Sentinel would be complete, but the Lower Manhattan Initiative, part of the plan to secure the city's financial area, is expected to be in place by 2010. And if after a month your license plate number is of no use to them, the police will reportedly delete it from their system. Live at the Holland Tunnel, Deborah Garcia, CBS 2 News.
They'll delete it, don't worry. You can trust the NYPD. But if we jump also to Danger Room, NYC Panopticon plans take shape. Plans for New York City's high-tech defense are beginning to coalesce. The NYPD wants license plate readers and radiation monitors scanning every vehicle entering Manhattan Island and a ring of checkpoints and concrete around the rebuilt World Trade Center site. Back in April, Danger Room presented an early look inside the plans, which also include a network of thousands of surveillance cameras spidering through New York's financial district. Of course, the most important part to protect. The latest proposal, called Operation Sentinel, calls for photographing and scanning the license plates of cars and trucks at all bridges and tunnels and using sensors to detect the presence of radioactivity. And you can hit up those links and you can read the backstory from Danger Room and hit up the New York Times article and just run searches on Operation Sentinel and ask the musical question, why has New York completely lost its mind? And maybe if we looked at the roots of some of these issues, we wouldn't have to do things like Operation Sentinel or anarchy at the GOP convention or what have you. There's a new documentary coming out very soon from Jason Burmess of Loose Change fame His new movie is called Fabled Enemies. Fabled Enemies is unlike any 9/11 documentary ever put together. Rather than focusing on the physical anomalies at the World Trade Center and Pentagon, thank God, this film follows the intelligence ties of Osama bin Laden, the alleged hijackers, and those who were actually detained on 9/11. The movie delves deeply into the roles of separate nations that were involved in supporting the 9/11 attacks. From Israel to Saudi Arabia to Pakistan and even the U.S. itself, no one is spared in this scathing exposé that pulls no punches. So get ready to learn how members of the FBI had their investigations into bin Laden obstructed and shut down, how the hijackers were trained at U.S. bases, that the military drills crippled our defenses and facilitated the attacks, and how the shadow government was actually activated that day. So there are two trailers up, little sneak previews. I put them both together. It's Fabled Enemies.
The relationship between bin Laden and the CIA was essentially... He was one of the assets, one of the people they could turn to. They wanted something done. They wanted bin Laden.
In the early 1980s, bin Laden worked with operatives from U.S. intelligence, the Pakistani military, and Arab states.
Is it not true that the United States government paid $300 million to the bin Laden family for the construction of the military camp?
At the basis, though, I really think that these were more CIA assets, people that were recruited, like all of the folks I've been issuing visas to.
Then we have that mysterious suitcase with all of the hijackers' names and all of this incriminating evidence. Why put a Koran? Why put flight manuals? Why put all this incriminating information if it's supposedly going to get burned up?
Let's show you some video that was taken 8 days after 9/11. That man there is Osama bin Laden's younger brother, Khalil.
And that family that took off, that's a f***ing crime.
I was surprised at the evidence that there were foreign governments involved. Most of that information is classified, I think overly classified.
Osama bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden.
Bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden.
Remember, 24 hours ago, it was the Bush tax cut, the Bush budget, Bush economy. You don't hear any of that tonight. It's America's enemy. America's under attack.
Fox News has learned that some American terrorism investigators fear certain suspects in the September 11th attacks may have managed to stay ahead of them.
Some U.S. investigators believe that there are Israelis, again, very much engaged in spying in and on the U.S.
Whether it's because they are in intelligence services or what they were doing, I will defer to the Department of Justice and the FBI.
That there was a report on the George Washington Bridge that there had been a van stopped there that had explosives.
We have a suspect who has driven from going to the van and then exploded.
Amdocs Limited, an Israeli-based private telecommunications company. It is virtually impossible to make a call on normal phones without generating an Amdocs record of it.
It quickly unraveled to be the largest foreign spy ring ever uncovered inside the United States. The largest.
Documents say that, quote, targeted and penetrated military bases, the DEA, FBI, and dozens of other government facilities.
There's one big elephant in the living room. Is the relationship between the United States of America and the State of Israel.
What about this question of advanced knowledge of what was going to happen on 9/11?
Well, it's very explosive information, obviously. A bigger question, they say, is how could they not have known?
That's two sneak previews, and you can watch both those trailers. It's Jason Burmes' new documentary, Fabled Enemies. So from Fabled Enemies to deadly Merck vaccines, teen illness blamed on Gardasil vaccine. A Michigan teen suffered a severe reaction 2 months after getting the Gardasil shot.
Jaquaria Williams doesn't get to act like a kid anymore. She's just too tired.
It kind of hurt. I used to do a lot.
But Jaquaria's mother says everything changed last December after her daughter received Gardasil, a vaccine that prevents 70% of cervical cancer.
She's never been sick, she's never been in a hospital, nothing, until the Gardasil shot.
2 months after getting the shot, Jaquaria says she got a rash on her face and arms, leaving these scars. She had swelling all over, pain in her joints, and poor circulation in her fingertips. Her doctor told us she now suffers from an autoimmune disease and says it is possible the Gardasil triggered her illness, though she made it clear the cause cannot be proven. According to a federal tracking system called VAERS, there have been 9,749 adverse reactions following the vaccination, and 21 reported deaths since 2006.
More adverse reactions to Gardasil. You can hit up the flashback links at the bottom of that story, such as hundreds get sick from Gardasil cancer vaccine, the latest absurd marketing scheme from Merck, and the one that kicked it all off. We've been tracking this since February 2007 when Texas Governor Rick Perry tried to mandate that all girls would have to receive Gardasil. But let's move. Let's not, actually. Let's at least visit and figure out just what the hell is going on in martial law, Arkansas. Crime wave brings 24-hour lockdown. So first from KTHV-TV, authorities say in an attempt to stop the violence, a neighborhood on the west side of Helena, West Helena, Arkansas, is under a 24-hour nonstop curfew that could be extended for days. It's a tale of two cities, the result of what police are calling a small gang turf war. Neighbors Mary Stevens, Flora Commons, and Antoine Johnson live in the middle of it. They've been shooting for 3 or 4 nights, says Commons. It's time to put a stop to all the crime. You can't sleep at night because people are shooting, and you want to know where the bullet is going to go next. Mayor James Valley, V-A-L-L-E-Y, says the impacted area is violence-prone, so from South Sebastian to 4th Street and Anderson to Garland Street, no one is allowed out. He says it's, quote, to curtail some of the general mayhem we've been experiencing, particularly the gunshots. Nobody can walk down the street and be safe, that is, be free from police interference. So we've got a couple clips, so let's take another visit down the road to Martial Law, Arkansas.
Go home or go to jail. Those are the only two options tonight for people living in one Mid-South neighborhood.
The mayor of Helena, West Helena, Arkansas, has issued a mandatory curfew. The curfew is in place for an area he refers to as a hot spot for crime. It applies to anyone, any age, and any time of day. As Eyewitness News Everywhere reporter Kevin Holmes uncovers, people who live in that area have mixed feelings on the mayor's decision.
Because of all the recent crime in Helena, West Helena, we're talking about robberies, home invasions, loitering, shootings, the mayor of Helena, West Helena, has decided to impose a curfew, but only in certain areas, and it applies for everyone, no matter the age and no matter the time. If you're caught violating curfew, there's a chance you could wind up behind bars.
We're afraid that somebody's going to be seriously hurt by what's going on. This curfew is for all people. Everybody is subject to stop an investigation. It's almost akin to martial law.
And that's exactly what some are calling it. For now, 2nd Street and several streets surrounding it will look just like this. And if you're caught outside without a good enough excuse,
it's zero tolerance. They're going to jail.
An idea that's fined by Martha Coleman.
You never know where a bullet is going to go. You never know who house is going to hit, what person is going to hit. And, you know, sleeping on the floor because you don't know where a bullet is going to, you know, go to. It might come in my house. It might come in my neighbor's house. So I commend the hell in the West Hall of the Police Department.
But others say instead of addressing the problem,
it's just going to make it worse.
And some say instead of home sweet home, the past 24 hours,
it's been like jail. You can't come out your own home. You can't go to the store without getting stopped by the police and questioned and harassed.
While Richard Robinson applauds the police efforts,
I think the idea is good to stop the crime, but I think the way that the police department is handling the situation is all wrong. When the police come out and tell you whether you own your own property or not, that you cannot come outside, I think that's martial law and that can only be inflicted by the National Guard. That's my opinion on it.
But after several rapes, robberies, and shootings, Mayor James Valley says he's exhausted all the possibilities, and he says this is the best move to turn around what some call in a very rough area.
This turf belongs to the taxpaying citizens, not to drug dealers and hustlers. And we're going to pop them in the head.
The mayor tells me he only has power to issue a 48-hour curfew, so when this one expires, to file paperwork to issue another one and another one and another one until city council takes action or until he sees some results. Now, we understand that residents aren't the only ones in uproar over the mayor's decision. So is the ACLU. And they've issued this statement late this afternoon. It's a letter to the mayor basically saying that he violates First, Fourth, and 14th Amendments. this, so this is far from over. And we'll stay on top of this and let you know what happens.
Are there any exceptions at all, any kind of wiggle room for people with this curfew?
Well, if you have a valid excuse, it's all on a case-by-case scenario. If you're there visiting family or if you have some legitimate business, again, legitimate business would be in the eye of the officer. If he or she feels that your business there is legitimate, then you're free to go.
All right, Kevin. Mayor James Valley says at least 10 people have been arrested since the curfew went into effect on Thursday.
Anyone caught outside the gates of their subdivision sector after curfew will be shot. I'm not sure what the current state of martial law Arkansas in Helena, West Helena is right now. But it ain't good. But hey, they only violated the 1st, 4th, and 14th Amendments. Shifting gears wildly, jumping over to Wired.com, the CERN, C-E-R-N, Super Collider begins testing this weekend. The Large Hadron Collider, that's H-A-D-R-O-N, the Large Hadron Collider, soon to be the world's most powerful atom smasher, begins testing this weekend. CERN will fire the first test beam through one of the particle accelerator's sectors. It's Let's See What Happens, Judy Jackson, head of the office communications at Fermilab, F-E-R-M-I-L-A-B, told Popular Mechanics. It's a very complex machine. This is a step towards getting ready. So then, on September 10th, a full power beam will travel through the accelerator's entire 17 miles of tunnels, reaching up to 99.99% of the speed of light. And finally, assuming all goes well, the first real science experiments will begin sometime in October. So we'll either make amazing scientific discoveries and or rip open the space-time continuum. And there's a vlog posted up on YouTube. It's below the story here, the Large Hadron Collider, the end of the universe. But we're not going to play that clip because we got to keep trucking on. Another mishmash of news under the heading NRA Mole, E-Passports, VP Lieberman, NWO, and the DC Madam. So first, from KPRC, NRA silent on alleged gun control mole. A Democratic U.S. senator demanded Thursday that the NRA, National Rifle Association, respond to charges it placed a paid spy in rival gun control organizations for more than a decade. The powerful firearms lobby has remained silent since reports broke last week that gun control activist Mary McFate, 62, of Sarasota, Florida, was allegedly snooping on several of the nonviolence groups spying on behalf of the NRA. Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey asked the NRA to confirm or deny the charge, reveal what she was paid, if anything, disclose the names of any other informants in the gun control movement, and imagine that, put a stop to the practice.
Gun control groups knew her as Mary McFate, a woman who they thought worked with them, opposing groups like the National Rifle Association. But according to the liberal magazine Mother Jones, Mary McFate is also Mary Sapone, a paid spy, it says, working for the NRA.
I think it was an underhanded, dishonest, venal trick on part of the gun lobby.
Brian Miller joined Ceasefire, a gun prevention group, after his brother, an FBI agent, was shot and killed. He worked with McFate at Ceasefire for 10 years, considered her a friend, a trusted colleague, who sat in on many meetings.
It certainly would be to the NRA's advantage or the gun lobby's advantage to know how we were going to message issues ahead of time, and they had that opportunity with Mary sitting in on, virtually every council.
Public records show Mary McFate has also used the name Mary Sapone and has an address in Sarasota, Florida. Mother Jones reports that a Mary Sapone once worked at a security firm where the NRA was one of her clients.
All appearances, Mary McFate was a committed anti-gun activist with a resume to prove it. A volunteer for several anti-gun violence groups, participant in the Million Mob March for stricter gun laws. She even ran for the board of the Brady Campaign to prevent gun violence.
I thought she was just one of the people that have been doing it for years and heart's in the right place and trying to make a difference.
According to a Mother Jones magazine, magazine investigation, Mary McPhee also had another resume and another name. As Mary Lou Sapone, she had a long history of infiltrating citizens' groups from private security firms to uncover their secrets, including work as a spy for the National Rifle Association.
When someone says they want to stand up and make a difference, generally you welcome them with open arms. You don't really expect them to be on the payroll of the NRA spying on you.
Mother Jones reports that in the mid-1990s, using her maiden name McFate, Mary Lou Sapone became an active member in anti-gun violence circles, finding ways to gain information about policy and strategy.
NRA informants, FBI informants, Gerald Ford informant. We'll get to that in a little bit. But there you go. Just like out of a Michael Moore movie. Infiltrating peace groups. Divide and conquer. I see now it's a minute into hour number two of episode 87. It's August 15th, 2008. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And you can hear the show Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time, revereradio.info. Thanks to the folks blasting me out on 95.3 in Boulder and 87.9 Ground Zero Radio in Atlanta. And as you may know, you can find me on MySpace and Dig and YouTube and Yahoo. I am Skype and Twitter and the rest with Media Monarchy as your keyword. iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org is where you get and share and love the podcast. We got a lot more to go through, my friends. We're only halfway, and it's going to take a bit to get through it. So let's jump to threat level. E-passports signed, sealed, delivered, but not like you may think. 2 years ago, security researcher Lucas Grunewald showed how the chips in new electronic passports could easily be cloned. But Grunewald's latest attack, however, was limited in that he hadn't found a way to alter data on the tag in a manner that could not be detected. Data on passport chips is hashed and digitally signed by the issuing country. Changing data on the passport chip would change the hash, indicating that the chip had been manipulated and thus invalidating it. Dutch security researcher Joren van Beek from the University of Amsterdam recently made headlines when the Times in London reported that he could get a cloned and manipulated passport chip to be recognized as legitimate by a passport reader. So there you go. You have further documentation of completely, utterly cloning and hackable RFID chips. From thinkprogress.org, surprise, surprise, I believe I've told you this, that Lieberman is reportedly on McCain's VP shortlist. Wow! I never would have thought. The Financial Times reports that Senator John McCain's campaign is vetting Senator Joseph Israel First Lieberman as a potential vice presidential running mate. One advisor said McCain loves Lieberman, and he's on the shortlist because Lieberman has never embarrassed anyone, never misspoken. The first rule is, don't take someone who costs you votes. The advisor also added, however, that many conservatives, quote, would be pissed as hell. Lieberman will also likely attend the GOP convention and may be speaking there amongst the provocateur anarchy that we mentioned earlier. There's a video posted up, and their username is TheyLive2012. New World Order Out of Chaos, The Coming Economic Depression. Are we facing financial Armageddon? Even as guys like Jim Cramer have said we are. I can't say I've ever lived through a depression, but it sure looks like it. And it looks like in the near future, doesn't look like some major event is going to be avoided. And it looks like, as always, the perpetrators will be the saviors once again, bringing the world under a more centralized framework and thus beginning the cashless society and the end of the middle class in the West and hello to socialism on a grand scale.
All through the summer of 1929, there had been ominous rumblings. For months, unemployment had been rising. Automobile sales and department store revenues had fallen off sharply. Across the South and West, farms were failing in record numbers. And still on Wall Street, the delirious optimism continued, undimmed.
as this continues to develop with the energy and food inflation and the distress in the financial and housing sector, is there anything comparable that you can point to in recent or distant history?
Well, I can point to pieces of it in a lot of places, but having them all at once the way we have now really goes back to the Great Depression in terms of having the broad spread effect.
As summer turned to fall, the mood changed. As the stock market dipped, then rose, then lurched downwards again, investors grew increasingly uneasy. In September, an economist named Roger Babson set a wave of fear rippling through Wall Street when he warned that sooner or later, a crash is coming, and it may be terrific.
And not in the good way, at least for us. And that frightening little juxtaposition is just the first minute of the video, New World Order Out of Chaos, the Coming Economic Depression, and you can watch that whole thing. The last story under this heading, D.C. Madam's attorney says that Deborah Jean Palfrey left instructions if ever found dead of apparent suicide. This coming from Lori Price over at Citizens for Legitimate Government, legitgov.org. Jean was very clear with me that if she was ever found dead of an apparent suicide, I was to make sure that all the evidence was publicly disseminated so that it could be independently evaluated. So this, exclusive from Citizens for Legitimate Government, has learned that Deborah Jean Palfrey's lawyer, Montgomery Blair Sibley, has intervened to stop a lawsuit seeking to prevent the Tarpon Springs, Florida Police Department from releasing information requested by Sibley pertaining to the investigation of the D.C. Madam's suiciding. If we jump now to europebusiness.blogspot.com and many other places, but not many, or rather any, or rather enough, massive U.S. naval armada heads for Iran. Operation Brimstone, which we covered a couple weeks ago on Media Monarchy, with a link for you to jump back to all those terror drills that were going on, like Lightning Rescue and Operation Brimstone and, I forget, some kind of Sentinel maybe. Operation Brimstone only ended a week ago. This was the joint U.S.-UK-French naval war games in the Atlantic Ocean preparing for a naval blockade of Iran and the likely resulting war in the Persian Gulf area. The massive war games included a U.S. Navy supercarrier battle group, a U.S. Navy expeditionary carrier battle group, a Royal Navy carrier battle group, a French nuclear hunter-killer submarine, plus a large number of U.S. Navy cruisers, destroyers, and frigates playing the, quote, enemy force. The blue team. No, the red team. Damn, which is it? The lead American ship in these war games, the USS Theodore Roosevelt, CVN-71, with a link, you can read all of its stats, and its carrier strike group 2, CCSG-2, are now headed towards Iran, along with the USS Ronald Reagan, CVN-76, and its carrier strike group 7, CCSG-7, coming from Japan. And fortunately, one man at least had something to say about this. Posted up on globalresearch.ca, Ron Paul says that the U.S. is heading into an illegal attack on Iran. Representative Ron Paul, Republican of Texas, campaignforliberty.com, has warned millions of radio listeners that the United States is heading into an illegal attack on Iran, stating his amazement at members of Congress who have openly voiced support for a criminal nuclear strike. Quote, if we do attack, it's going to be a disaster, the congressman told the Alex Jones radio show. I was astounded to see on one of the networks the other day that the debate was not going to be, are we going to attack, but are we going to attack before or after the election? Paul recently voiced concern over House Congressional Resolution 362, which he has dubbed a virtual Iran war resolution. And you can hit that link and read the story back on MediaMonarchy.com when we covered it in June. A virtual Iran war resolution. However, we can wonder now if that's not on the table or not in the cards anymore, as we now shifted our attention to Georgia and Russia. But we're not there just yet. We've got some updates on the totalitarian Olympics. First, from the Associated Press, White House press corps plane detained in China. A charter airplane carrying the White House press corps was detained for nearly 3 hours last Friday at Beijing's International Airport, not long after President Bush arrived to attend the Olympic Games. The flight crew of the Northwest Airlines 747 had been expecting to park at a VIP terminal, but after landing was instead directed by the control tower to a normal international gate. White House officials would say only there were, quote, logistical problems getting clearance to unload the aircraft. The flight crew was told the Chinese were insisting that all luggage be inspected. On a much sadder and darker note, relative of U.S. coach killed in Beijing. This from the Washington Times. A Chinese man stabbed the in-laws of the U.S. Olympic men's volleyball coach, killing one and injuring the other while they visited a Beijing tourist site near the main venue where Olympic competition began last Saturday.
Minneapolis might well be a more beautiful city because of Todd Bachman, the American tourist who was killed in Beijing in what appears to be a random stabbing shortly after the Olympics began. Bachman was the CEO of a multi-million dollar floral company based in Minneapolis, with dozens of stores across the state and more than 1,000 employees. Bachman family name has been familiar to outdoor lovers and gardeners in Minnesota for decades.
Todd Bachman was a stellar member of the community. He has stores all over the Twin City area, and he employs a huge number of people. He gives a lot back to the community. It's horrible to lose someone like Todd Bachman.
The 62-year-old was a big fan of volleyball. His daughter Elizabeth, who was with him but was not hurt in the attack, played on the U.S. women's team in the 2004 Olympic Games. Bachman's wife, Barbara, also suffered serious stab wounds. She's been hospitalized, along with their Chinese tour guide, who also was injured.
We are simply overwhelmed with a gratitude and the outpouring of sympathy and well wishes from all over the world.
Violence against foreigners is rare in China, and authorities say there's no indication the assailant, who jumped to his death following the attack, knew his victims had any connection to the games. Officials say security had been tightened at scenic spots around the city, and President Bush has praised China for its quick response to the attack. Sophia Manos, The Associated Press.
So Bush praised China for their swift police state action. Just like Barack Obama didn't send condolences to the family of Bill Guatney, he congratulated the Arkansas police on blowing the guy away quickly. If we jump to McClatchy, heat and humidity taking toll on athletes at Olympics. If it's not the smog, it's the heat and humidity. The thick gray cap of haze over the Chinese capital abated slightly last Saturday, but temperatures soared into the mid-90s, and some Olympic athletes wilted. Several cyclists pulled out of the road race, unable to cope with the sticky heat, and a Swiss men's beach volleyball team resorted to a medical break to catch a brief respite from the sizzling sun and the high humidity that just wouldn't allow sweat to evaporate. Many athletes were worried less about the heat than air pollution upon arriving in Beijing, one of the most polluted cities in the world. Microscopic particles that comprise the city's thick haze can aggravate those who suffer from asthma and irritate eyes and nasal passages. Please consult a physician. There was also one, I'm not sure I have it linked up in there, but when some of the athletes arrived, they got off the plane wearing surgical masks. Finally, two last things under the totalitarian Olympics updates. The 9/11 TV fakery fans go wild. We've got Chinese fireworks and Olympic TV fakery from Sky News. Parts of the spectacular Beijing Olympics opening ceremony were faked, it has emerged. The global television audience of more than 3 billion people watched in amazement as a series of giant footprints outlined in fireworks proceeded through the night sky from Tiananmen Square to the Bird's Nest Stadium. Except they were watching a computer simulation.
It turns out the grand fireworks during the Olympic opening ceremonies weren't as grand after all. Beijing Olympic organizers are now confirming that some fireworks featured in the opening Olympic broadcast were pre-recorded and some were computer-generated.
On the day of the ceremony, there were actual footprints fireworks from the south to the north of the city. However, because of the poor visibility of the night, some previously recorded footage may have been used.
NBC says hosts Bob Costas and Matt Lauer revealed the cinematic display on the air in the United States. Fireworks aren't the only illusions at the games. It turns out the Chinese girl who sang Ode to the Motherland during the opening ceremonies was lip-syncing. The actual 7-year-old singer was replaced at the last minute when a member of the Chinese Politburo declared her face not suitable for the opening ceremonies. Dave Lebesky, The Associated Press, Beijing.
You can hit up the MSNBC story, Chinese defend Olympic ceremony lip sync. Chinese officials defended their decision to pass off the voice of a 7-year-old songbird as that of another girl at the Olympics opening ceremony, calling it a simple casting choice. Critics said it was a step too far in China's obsession with the perfect Olympic Games. That reminds me of some other country who had an obsession with pulling off the perfect Olympic Games to showcase their perfect man. I forget what that was. We now come to the most important story. U.S. attacks Russia through client state Georgia. And there's a lot here, and I'm only going to be able to skim the surface, but there's a lot of links and tons of video, so you can learn about all this, just as I'm trying to as well. First, from Paul Joseph Watson, Georgian forces, trained and equipped by the Pentagon and the U.S. government, killed 10 Russian peacekeepers early last Friday morning in a provocation attack that has escalated into military conflict. But the subsequent corporate media coverage would have us believe that the U.S. and NATO-backed client state Georgia is a helpless victim, when in actual fact a far more nuanced geopolitical strategy is being played out. Original reports early that Friday morning detailed how Georgian forces had killed 10 Russian peacekeepers and wounded 30 others. There's the link to the Reuters report for you. And it was the provocation for which Russian forces started to begin military operations, but the fact that Georgian forces were responsible for starting the conflagration have been completely buried in subsequent media coverage. Georgia and the Pentagon cooperate closely, reports MSNBC. Georgia has a 2,000-strong contingent supported by the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq, and Washington provides training and equipment to the Georgian military. That's a quote from MSNBC. The latest exercise, Immediate Response 2008... That's one of those that was going along with Operation Brimstone and Lightning Rescue. The latest exercise, Immediate Response 2008, which took place last month, involved no less than 1,000 U.S. troops working with Georgian troops in a war game scenario. Moreover, the very Rose Revolution, with a link you can read more about that, the very Rose Revolution that brought the Harvard-trained pro-U.S. Georgian president Mikhail Saakashvili to power in 2003 was wholly aided and abetted by the CIA. So if we jump to Danger Room, Russia's full-scale invasion of Georgia. Russia has launched a full-scale military invasion, Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili said in Tbilisi, Georgia's capital. Saakashvili is planning to withdraw Georgia's entire 2,000-man contingent from Iraq within 3 days to help repel the Russians, even as Saakashvili calls for, quote, an immediate ceasefire in a conflict that Russian officials claim has killed 2,000 and left 30,000 homeless. The Russian defense minister tells the New York Times that, quote, 100 plane loads of airborne troops will be flown into the conflict zone on top of the 2,500 troops already estimated to be in the country. Those are just a couple of the early reports that came out when this fired up just a week ago. The U.S.-Russia proxy war through Georgia. So let's learn a little bit more, and then we'll hit some of the updates and more.
A dramatic situation is playing out near the Russian border as the conflict over the breakaway province of South Ossetia escalates sharply. In an interview with CNN, the Georgian president, Mikhail Saakashvili, says his country is under attack. Says Russian tanks and troops have invaded his territory. This after Georgia launched an offensive in the province of South Ossetia. The president said Russia's actions were carefully planned.
The military situation is quite tense. First of all, I would like to underline it. It also U.S. actually is an integral part of Georgia, like any U.S. state is a part of the United States of America. So what is happening now is Georgian territory, Georgian sovereign territory, and what we are doing is we are defending our economy, our territory from aggression. And aggressor in this case is Russia, who is directly attacking our territory and our people. And they are, I can label it as a direct war against the neighboring countries.
On Wednesday, the world witnessed violent clashes in Tbilisi, which sparked much condemnation for the brutal methods used by the police. Georgian policemen and special forces were cruelly beating protesters with fists and batons. At the receiving end of the blows were mostly unarmed people. But it was also a display of power of a different kind. Georgian special forces unveiled their high-tech equipment and used it to disperse the crowds.
The war, for surely it must now be called a war, is widening. These images of the aftermath of a morning raid by Russian warplanes on the Georgian town Gori, 30 kilometers from the front. Gori has become the staging post for Georgian forces. The Russian attacks may have been intended for military targets. Some missed. Most of these Georgian soldiers haven't seen the front line yet. They're fresh-faced reservists ready to go in, called up in President Saakashvili's full military mobilization on Friday. Georgia continues to insist that Russia is the aggressor in all of this. One question mark remains. Was this pre-planned assault timed to coincide with world leaders being preoccupied with the Olympic Games in Beijing?
We shall see. So if we return to the posting, U.S. attacks Russia through client state, Georgia. We've got videos, Georgia, South Ossetia, roots of a 100-year conflict. We've got evidence of U.S. military presence in Georgia. 10 videos all on one page, 10 video reports on the conflict in Georgia. Then there's one from Kurt Nemo. Did U.S. and Israel provocateur South Ossetia conflict? Does the sun come up in the morning? Dead civilians in South Ossetia, but you'll not hear much about it on CNN or Faux News because they're too busy reporting ad nauseum about the extramarital shenanigans of CFR darling John Edwards. In order to find out what's really been going on in Georgia, you have to read the international press on the internet. Bush, McCain, and Obama may cast blame on Russia, but reading the international press, you get a different perspective. And so there are quotes from everything from the International Herald Tribune to Pravda. But I also have a dozen or so updates, like from Danger Room. Putin issues ultimatum, Georgia stands alone. Neocon calls for U.S. to launch a war with Russia. Civilian genocide, dead Americans, the cost of U.S.-Russia proxy war. Israel, or rather an Israeli, has $1 billion invested in Georgia. That's from IsraelNationalNews.com. There's a video from Raw Story. Georgians in L.A. rally for peace. Russia announces war halt. Fighting continues. Georgia declares ceasefire in breakaway province. And, of course, those didn't work out. There is one that lays it out plainly from Cryptogon.com. It is largely about oil pipelines. Ossetians say West is behind conflict. Russians occupy city, break ceasefire. Using Georgia to target Russia, that's from globalresearch.ca. We've got a video of a Russian cameraman accusing CNN, quite effectively accusing CNN, of airing misleading footage. You know, they kind of flip-flopped who was attacking who. The media war against Russia, re-chilling the Cold War. Russia-Georgia conflict offers glimpse at new world order. We also have a video of Georgian President Saakashvili calling for a future world order. There's also a video from Colonel Sam Gardner saying, quote, if U.S. attacks Russia, Russia will use nuclear weapons. An interesting one from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, AJC.com. Troops from Atlanta will train in the Republic of Georgia. And finally, a video up on YouTube. U.S. is behind the Georgia-Russian war. So that's all the updates I have on the proxy war. And hopefully, as I come to you right now, terrible things aren't happening. But I'll have to check in a little bit. Because now we got to jump back into the past. Back into 1963 and 64. Gerald Ford was an informant for the FBI who ratted out those couple of guys on the Warren Commission who were, quote, not convinced that JFK was shot from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. This first one from the AP. Former President Ford secretly advised the FBI that two of his fellow members on the Warren Commission doubted the FBI's conclusion that JFK was shot from the sixth floor of the Texas Book Depository in Dallas. This according to newly released records from Ford's FBI files. The new details were included in 500 pages of the FBI's large file on Ford, released in part this past week in response to requests under the Freedom of Information Act that the AP and others made on the day Ford died in December 2006. The FBI intends to release additional documents about Ford in several batches, all with parts censored for law enforcement and privacy reasons. That Ford served as the FBI's eyes and ears inside the commission has been known for years. Long ago, the government released a 1963 FBI memo that said Ford, then a Republican congressman from Michigan, had volunteered to keep the FBI informed about the panel's private deliberations, but only if that relationship remained confidential. The Bureau agreed. Two members of the commission brought up the fact that they were still not convinced that the president had been shot from the sixth floor window of the Texas Book Depository. These members failed to understand the trajectory of the slugs that killed the president. He stated he felt this point would be discussed further, but of course would represent no problem. There was no explanation of what Ford meant by no problem. No problem, cover up.
Newly released FBI file is revealing a different look at the investigation into the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Documents show Gerald Ford, then a congressman, secretly advised the FBI that two of his fellow members on the Warren Commission doubted JFK had been shot from the sixth floor of the Texas Book Depository. The FBI's large file on Ford was released in part this past week in response to requests under the Freedom of Information Act made by the media on the day Ford died in 2006. The file offers detailed descriptions of Ford's work as an FBI informant.
Unfortunately, the fine folks at Raw Story, in posting up this story, include links to the PDFs of some of the released documents. So you can hit up, there's four links for you, PDF format, 1959 memo regarding Ford's subversive nature, 1965 memo on security check on Ford's phone, 1963 memo, two Warren Commission members doubted FBI's conclusions in JFK assassination. So there's three for you, I misspoke. But they're there for you. See the documentation. I mentioned earlier my birthday buddy, Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf. We both had our birthday back on the 11th. Musharraf, however, is on the ropes as Pakistan preps for impeachment. And, of course, we can infer that instability there will somehow tie in with regime change. So this again from Winter Patriot. President Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan, the former Army Chief of Staff who took power in a coup in 1999, is suddenly facing impeachment. The Daily Times lists the charges against Musharraf, and you can hit that link to read about him, but right now we'll cut to the chase. Musharraf's next logical moves would be a declaration of martial law, dissolution of the National Parliament and the Provincial Assemblies, and incarceration of all opposition political leaders. I would not be surprised if he did all these things, or at least tried to, and I would also not be surprised to see Bush do any or all of these things, or at least try to, even absent the threat of impeachment. Desperate, despicable people tend to do desperate, despicable things, especially when their illegitimate hold on power is threatened. And just some of the updates taking us up to at least, I believe, last night. But we have from Press TV, Pakistan government hailed over Musharraf impeachment. U.S. ways stepped up military forays into Pakistan, and finally, most recently, I believe, from thinkprogress.org and the New York Times, Musharraf expected to resign. So from Pakistan to my home state of West Virginia. West Virginia offers licenses for those who fear the beast. West Virginia started keeping a driver's license photo out of a computer database for members of a small religious group who believe the digital storage is a, quote, mark of the beast that evokes biblical prophecy.
Pastor Phil Huddock and his friends are on a mission to keep their driver's license photo out of a government database.
I've been told by government officials that eventually there will be a worldwide database, and so that digital image could go into Interpol and be an identifier of me, and it's kind of like saying, well, the state owns me.
The Department of Motor Vehicles compromised with people who believe it's against their faith to have a digitized photo stored in a database because they believe it's a step closer to the mark of the beast prophecy.
Well, just don't want to be tracked.
I'm not going to be tracked. No. And my background, I'm not a lawbreaker by no means, but my background is none of their business. Absolutely not. And I'm not giving it to them.
The image, the digital picture that's on the driver's license will not be kept in our database. We will make a copy of it on an 8x11 sheet and keep it in a file folder for law enforcement should it be necessary.
Well, I haven't had a driver's license, state-issued driver's license, 10 years because I would not take a good picture.
Yeah. Now Butch Paul and those who follow his belief can drive legally and within the boundaries of their faith. Dave Benton, WSAZ News Channel 3, Charleston.
So you heard the awesome Pastor Butch Paul out of Southern West Virginia. I think he has a show on GCN. And as long as we're mentioning West Virginia, I'll mention that I saw the X-Files movie the other morning. Had a nice little screening at 11:30 in the morning on my birthday, Monday. No one in the theater. It's the way to go. But for the most part, the new X-Files movie is pretty much set in the made-up town of Somerset, West Virginia. And it's not supernatural at all. It's mostly a organ thief kind of story. But anyway. So I mentioned news that breaks while I'm doing the show here on Friday morning. This was one that I saw as soon as I got home last Friday. So I posted it up under the heading that John Edwards is out of the running for the VP slot. And we must make a note that the story was broken months ago by, frighteningly enough, one of the last independent media outlets left, the National Enquirer. And you can hit a link there and read and remember that they were the ones that got sent anthrax. So, from ABC, John Edwards admitted to ABC News in an interview with Bob Woodruff last Friday that he repeatedly lied about an extramarital affair with a 42-year-old campaign employee, but strenuously denied being the baby daddy.
Breaking news tonight. John Edwards admits he had an affair with a woman who worked as a video producer for his campaign and that he lied about it repeatedly while he was running for president. The woman, Rielle Hunter, gave birth to a daughter in February. Edwards insists he is not the little girl's father. This afternoon, he put out a statement. In it, he said, quote, in 2006, I made a serious error in judgment and conducted myself in a way that was disloyal to my family, to my core beliefs. I recognized my mistake and I told my wife that I had a liaison with another woman, and I asked for her forgiveness. Although I was honest in every painful detail with my family, I did not tell the public. When a supermarket tabloid told a version of the story, I used the fact the story contained many falsities to deny it. But being 99% honest is no longer enough. I was and am ashamed of my conduct and choices, and I had hoped that it would never become public.
So whether a honeypot or just a hookup, or God knows what. It's just another stunning, but actually not so stunning anymore, disgusting betrayal by the corrupt two-party, two sides of the same coin system. And so, now what's going to happen? That was the last bit of news from this last week. It's been piling up on me, and there's a lot of stuff to go over, and a lot of things I've missed. A lot of 9/11 updates, police state USA, tons of stuff on the ongoing anthrax psyop, clips from Richard Andrew Grove, and more. So let's turn our songbooks to a couple pages deep into MediaMonarchy.com and hit up some of the latest episodes of Outside the Box with Portland, Oregon's own Alex Ansari. He, of course, has a twice-weekly radio show on We the People Radio Network, WTPRN.com, but his TV show plays once a week on Portland Community Media. Several new episodes up. First, we got episode 161 with William Puckett of UFOs Northwest. That's UFOSNW.com. Episode 62 and episode 63 of Outside the Box. 163 has George Green, former investment banker who has published a series of books called The Handbook for the New Paradigm, which he says were written by ET intelligence. There's a bonus interview from Alex Ansari as well, where he travels up to Trout Lake, Washington to talk with ufologist James Gilliland about the phenomenon on July 6, 2008. ahealedplanet.net is James's website. So that's some of the latest from Alex Ansari and Outside the Box. But now we're going to jump to Richard Andrew Grove and 9/11 Synchronicity and 8thEstate.com, as well as the new show he's been doing with Maria Heller at meria.net, maria.net. So a couple things from who I have to say was probably the greatest inspiration to start doing the Media Monarchy podcast was Richard Andrew Grove and his show 9/11 Synchronicity and just his work and everything he's done. So a salute to him and two great clips. They're all busted up on YouTube, but We Are Change Colorado interviewed 9/11 whistleblower Richard Andrew Grove. And I'll read a little bit more about that. But there's also a new full-length documentary that he put together called A Film to End All Wars.
Well, you look into Kroll, and they're, you know, they do kidnap and ransom protection and insurance for insurance companies like AIG, for instance.
Look, Sammy, all my clients have kidnap and ransom insurance.
Not a policy. AIG, my dad gave it to me.
Yeah, I know. I got it from your dad. But what are you going to do in 60 days when you can't renew it? You can't because you don't have bodyguard.
I know. I had to let Amelia go.
AIG owns a majority share. On Kroll's board of directors, as on AIG's board of directors, is the son of CIA co-founder Frenchie Kissner. Right? So there was another connection. And then Kroll is then sold. Kroll not only has the security contracts over the World Trade Center, but they used to build armored cars to protect the president. You know, so they have a history of working in executive enforcement or executive protection, right? So what you have is, at the time of 9/11, you have the involvement of Kroll Associates, of which Jerry Hauer, who you might have heard about through the anthrax lawyer, right? And he was also President Bush's Office of Emergency Management
director, managing director of Kroll.
Yeah.
We figure Hauer as a major player.
So all those people, they're all Wall Street bankers in the intelligence agencies. The CIA helped to create Mossad and the State of Israel. I mean, when you look at it, I was watching a documentary on the history of the Mossad this morning, and they say that in their documentary about how Alan Dulles had such a part in creating all this stuff.
By the end of World War II, Jews throughout the world considered Palestine their homeland. But Palestine was then ruled by the British under a United Nations mandate that permitted only a trickle of refugees in. Harrow was influenced by post-war American intelligence, in particular the 1947 formation of the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. This led to the creation of Israel's Central Institute for Intelligence and Special Duties, or Mossad, which replaced the Foreign Ministry's political department. Harrow was appointed as its head in September 1952. The Mossad became synonymous with Israeli intelligence. Prime Minister Ben-Gurion promptly increased the Mossad's budget tenfold.
So when you understand those characters and you have more than a fourth grade history education on these things, because they don't teach you this stuff in school, you have to go out and read a lot of books, and they're not easy books to get because they're not going to sell them to you at Barnes & Noble in the store. But they're,
right. Well,
they're gettable.
So look at Brzezinski's tight relationship with Barack Obama.
That's my point. Thank you.
Exactly. Whistleblower Richard Grove has completed a monumental expose, A Film to End All Wars, which reveals facts about the atrocities of 9/11 that have heretofore remained untold. From his previous position as a corporate insider, Richard takes us behind the scenes and details the specific financial and corporate underpinnings of the greater 9/11 story. And you just heard just a moment of a film to end all wars. So definitely, always with the highest amount of recommendation and admiration, my man Richard Andrew Grove, 8thestate.com. Now let's get... Oh, it's going to get ugly. Let's go through some of the anthrax psyop updates. So you could just bookmark my posting massive anthrax updates. The case is far from closed. That's been the one post I just keep going back to and posting things up because it would threaten to take over the whole page if I made new posts for every time something new, some new question arises about Dr. Ivins and his suicide and the anthrax follies. So just some of the things in here. Hair samples in anthrax case don't match. Flashback on 9/11, high government official advises some reporters to take anthrax antibiotic Cipro. Dr. Ivins, anthrax, and why I don't believe the FBI. We've got Project Anthrax and the cover-up, five parts and running, from Alex Constantine. We've got Patrick Hatfield, Ivins and Human Experimentation, Anthrax Follies and the Bizarro Effect by Justin Raimondo over at Antiwar. Lawyer skeptical FBI could have convicted Ivins. A couple of worthy flashbacks here. Bayer reduces price of anthrax antibiotic Cipro for the U.S. government only. And also, as anthrax fears mount, Canada overrides Bayer's patent for Cipro. And those flashbacks you can always get from historycommons.org. We've also got one. If I were a betting man, I'd wager that Cheney was behind the anthrax attacks. We've got one from Sander Hicks, mad scientist Ivins, and other 9/11 legends. Anthrax suspect passed two polygraphs. Three key questions still unanswered in anthrax case. Some question FBI's anthrax case. 16 labs had the killer anthrax strain. FBI will analyze Ivins' computer. Anthrax case raises doubts on security. That's from the Washington Post. From the Washington Times, sorority fixation may be key clue. Anthrax plot started early, will drag on. Anthrax suspect's lab, rat's nest. The FBI selective release of documents in the anthrax case. Ivins went nuts, but it was the FBI who drove him there. Anthrax letters are not in Ivins' handwriting. That's from 911blogger.com. Widow of first anthrax victim says she believes FBI account. We've got another flashback. A strange coincidence briefly increases suspicion Al-Qaeda is behind anthrax attacks. Like you probably saw the clip of John McCain on David Letterman saying as much. Project Anthrax and the Cover-Up, the five-part article I mentioned from Alex Constantine. Some of the subtitles are the El Hibri Loop, Hatfill and Special Forces, Introduction to Vaxgen, Ivins Redux, and Rumsfeld. And there's more and more, but let's listen to a wide host of opinions. Webster Tarpley, Rush Holt, Keith Olbermann, and even Teresa Mitchell on Portland's own KBOO.FM. But let's read about and listen about and learn about the anthrax psyop.
So this was very effective psy war. It was also used very consciously by the FBI to take investigators who were supposedly looking into 9/11 and to divert them to something completely different. It's very interesting that the FBI has never solved this crime. I think it's a key to the bankruptcy of their investigative procedures in general, if that were still needed. One thing that's clear is that the anthrax spores that are involved here come from U.S. military labs.
A lot of it is just consternation about the ridiculous motives they're attributing. And I get upset whenever I hear.
What do you mean the ridiculous motives? They're saying that perhaps it was for financial gain, that he had created a new vaccine for anthrax, and this was a way to test it out.
He was one of five researchers who patented that. The patent is owned by the United States government. There may be some small monetary incentives, but the government owns that patent. There were five other people. It's more a Friedlander's vaccine than anybody else's, I think, in addition to Farshas. He's the one that made the original recombinant.
The government is also suggesting that he was able to transform these spores in the laboratory into this powdered form. You dispute that. You say it's highly unlikely.
I don't know. I was the division chief, and I didn't know that anybody did that in USIMRID. All of the challenges that we did with animals were with wet spores. All of the aerosols were with wet spores. The dry spores, I wasn't aware of. Now, there are things that weren't aware of, that's another thing.
You've said you've been so involved, and Senator Daschle and Leahy have also complained about the same thing, even though Senator Leahy chairs the Judiciary Committee with oversight of the Justice Department and was one of the targets of the anthrax attacks. Do you have information about the current case against Bruce Ivins other than what has been leaked? And given the amount that has been leaked now, which is increasing by the minute, of course, have you formed an opinion about how persuasive you find that case, or are you withholding judgment on that until the FBI sort of presents the full panoply of whatever it is that they claim they have?
Well, as a congressional representative, I shouldn't play the role of judge, jury, or forensic scientist. I don't have a lot, as I said, I'm watching how the collected evidence. I don't have a lot of confidence, and I think the burden is on them to satisfy me that and other members of Congress that they've done this right.
The government may be able this week to close its investigation of the 2001 anthrax terror. How wonderfully convenient. A flesh-out case characterized as circumstantial by a thorough journalistic assessment, and the lone mad scientist cannot answer any of it because he's dead. Case closed. However, in our third story in the countdown, it may not remove that word circumstantial, and it won't even address the troubling collateral issue, how the Bush administration reportedly pushed FBI Director Robert Mueller to prove this narrative, that the 2001 attacks were in fact a second-wave terror effort by Al-Qaeda or by somebody from the Middle East. In the direct aftermath of those attacks, in October 2001, during President Bush's morning intelligence briefings, the director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, was quote-unquote beaten up for not producing proof that the anthrax spores were the work of Osama bin Laden. This according to an unnamed former aide to Mueller, a former now-retired senior FBI official speaking to the New York Daily News. They really wanted to blame somebody in the Middle East, the official said. But even then, the FBI already knew that the anthrax sent to media outlets, including NBC News, and to the offices of two U.S. senators was a military strain, according to this source. Very quickly, Fort Detrick, Maryland experts told us this was not something some guy in a cave could come up with. They couldn't go from box cutters one week to weapons-grade anthrax the next.
Well, my first news this morning is the anthrax case isn't over. Can't be. Ain't over. The attempt by the FBI to close the anthrax case represents some of the worst propaganda and corruption we have to endure as a society. To be sure, there are ongoing horrors, such as the daily disproportionate arrest, sentencing, and prison chaining of African Americans, and the anthrax scare is largely behind us now, although it's still possible to scare the wits out of some people by spilling some flour and yelling, which I don't suggest. But this is bad. We're supposed to believe now that a certain Mr. Ivins was solely responsible for processing American AIMS strain anthrax into a static polarized bundle, a pretty high-tech thing, something done only at the most advanced U.S. production facilities. Amazingly, he was supposed to have done this with no other help. We were supposed to disregard the fact that his own colleagues find the accusation fantastic, that he developed an anti-anthrax vaccine after the attacks, and that despite all of this activity, the FBI could not find one spore of AIMS anthrax on his clothing, automobiles, house, or office. Nothing. No evidence. Zero. Zip.
There's no way I can go through all the massive anthrax updates I have posted up, but rest assured there are dozens of them, and they're all disturbing. There's a few other postings that I'm not going to be able to go through or read fully into the record, but as I was running around and out of town and on the East Coast getting behind, I posted up a couple things, also called An Ugly Mess of News, Part 1 and 2. All kinds of 9/11 and police state and MilTech and Enviro Health updates, such as The billboard displays a burning World Trade Center with the slogan, "Please don't vote for a Democrat." Jack Blood on Deadline Live broke a major story that work has been done to prove that Muhammad Atta was in Oklahoma City in September 2001 using government-issued credit card numbers. And those links and recordings are up there for you. There's also PDX 9/11 Truth on a video up on Google from Omega Presents. Also, actress Heather Thomas is one of the latest celebrities to question 9/11. TMZ even picked up the story. We've got news about the Greens nominating McKinney for president. A cast of 300 advises Obama on foreign policy. The dedication of Ron Paul, and McCain says only World War III would justify a draft. Looking in the police state news, things like U.S. military to patrol internet, fusion centers implementing the control grid. I just learned that Oregon's fusion center is in Salem. Gun grabbers at the Chicago Tribune, three deny JFK terror plot claims. Mandatory in-car breathalyzers coming. We've got more war game and private military contractor news, geopolitics, military technology, more and more, population control, eugenics connection, vaccinated chickens in Vietnam die of bird flu, 50,000 scientists sign a paper disavowing and disbelieving man-made global warming, Oliver Stone's film JFK is going to get the Blu-ray treatment from Warner Brothers on November 11th, just 11 days before the 45th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. We've got drug smugglers bribing U.S. agents on the border. Nazi doctor is alive in Chile. We've got Freemason North American Union pyramids in Princeton, West Virginia. Christopher Hitchens being waterboarded on video for a Vanity Fair article. Cult leader Sun Myung Moon was injured in a helicopter crash. Now, I mentioned the Jack Blood story. You can hit up Total 411 and read about 9/11 hijacker patsies had FedGov credit cards in Oklahoma City. Another important bit of 9/11 news buried in the ugly mess of news. If we hit up historycommons.org, after 10:15 a.m., September 11, 2001, police see people, including military personnel, stealing debris from Pentagon crash site. Two Pentagon police officers see people, some of them members of the military, stealing crash debris from in front of the Pentagon. After the Pentagon was hit, Lieutenant Robbie Turner had been helping the injured at a triage area when at around 10:15 a.m., reports are received of a possible second plane heading for the Pentagon. And so there's quotes and sources of policing people and military personnel stealing debris from the Pentagon crash site, and there are some interesting photos of that we've seen. If we hit up now an ugly mess of news part two, there's other disturbing things. But the good one is the New York City ballot initiative is closing in on the amount of signatures that it needs. We've got a video of Obama being confronted about the Federal Reserve and his string puller Zbigniew Brzezinski and 9/11. And there's tons and tons more there. My eyes are starting to cross scrolling over them. But you can read about the movie WALL-E and the Malthusian agenda. You can read about Batman and the Dark Knight and the War on Terror. You can read about 888 anniversary protests in Burma. The Knights Templar heirs are in a legal battle with the Pope. We also have a report that there is going to be an I-9/11 and an I-Patriot Act, discussing the idea that some sort of infotech attack will be the next 9/11, thereby requiring a new Patriot Act. There's also a RAND Corporation report that concludes that the war on terror, as it has been defined, isn't an effective way to win. So basically, even the RAND Corporation says that the war on terror ain't working. Maybe they just need to rebrand it. But you can hit up the Telegraph for the Knights Templar Heirs in Legal Battle with the Pope. That's a fun one. And finally, the July Clearinghouse. Like I said, we're digging back. But you can read about the 100th anniversary of the FBI. You can see the clip of Sky News, and I believe I played that a couple weeks ago, where they praise Obama's speech as a call for a new world order. Kucinich testifying at executive power hearing. Tased until dead, the epidemic of taser crazy cops. Astronaut says government covering up UFOs. And we have a video / audio. We covered the story that it came out in Maryland and in D.C. The police were spying on anti-war protesters. So we've got a clip of the police chief defending spying on protesters because, you know, they might be terrorists.
The head of the Maryland State Police is speaking for the first time since controversial surveillance of anti-war and anti-death penalty groups became public knowledge. Weijia Jiang has more on what the governor is saying.
They say death! 2005, two high-profile death sentences are issued, one in February, another in November.
The death penalty's got to go!
Angry protesters rise to action, resulting in a questionable action from the Maryland State Police.
We hadn't had executions for a while, then we had one in 2004, and then two scheduled close together. And the concern was because the state police do provide a security, they're going to ensure the safety of those people.
The solution? Keep a very watchful eye. In a 43-page document, the American Civil Liberties Union shows two troopers went on to monitor Baltimore activists during 2005 and 2006. A list of Marylanders appear on a terrorist database.
The saddest thing maybe about it is that our meetings are open. Anyone can come to our meetings.
We have yet to find a real good answer to the question of, you know, what evidence, what reasonable basis did you have to go to the extent of sending in an undercover state trooper into these groups.
The monitoring ends on May 8, 2006.
What troubles me about the method of information gathering in this, that it continued after it appeared no criminal activity was occurring or being planned.
Colonel Sheridan reiterated several times that he knew nothing about monitoring when it was going on, even though at the time he was a Baltimore County Police Commissioner and he served on a Homeland Security Advisory Board.
I have no knowledge of ever receiving a report about this.
Sheridan says the previous commander of the Homeland Security and Intelligence Commission ordered the monitoring. He says nothing like this will happen under his administration. Weijia Jiang, WJZ, Eyewitness News.
The Maryland State Police is looking into its policy on undercover operations. Sheridan says no such monitoring will happen under his administration.
COINTELPRO alive and well. And I can't do no more, but let me stress, as I have in the past, that I can only scratch the surface here on the radio show, that you got to hit up MediaMonarchy.com, where all the news and links and audio and video and full uncut clips and articles and PDFs and all the research material. Don't take my word for it. Check it out yourself. Lastly, as I do on the show, I keep track of some of the visitors that land on MediaMonarchy.com through my stat counter. So this last week, lots of interesting visitors. The St. Petersburg Times googled USS Martha's Vineyard and the Philadelphia Experiment. The FAA out of OKC googled uranium found in Iraq shipped to Canada. Fort Jackson in Maryland. We're reading about the Playboy model who was kicked out of the Air Force. Lutheran Medical Center in Denver googled Nancy Pelosi and New World Order. The IBM Corporation googled Rex 84 Blackwater Garden Plot. We had the Pentagon visiting from an email link. We had the Department of Homeland Security out of Springfield land after googling FEMA suspends procurement for upcoming top-off drill. We had the Office of Civil Health and Medical Program of the Uniformed Services out of Aurora, Colorado. They googled Clint Murchison fraud security. Adorable Junior Garments Incorporated out of Quebec googled teen illness blamed on Gardasil. We had Jack in the Box Incorporated Google Internet 2 conspiracy. Texas Department of Insurance were appropriately googling Governor Manchin fire. Royal Caribbean Celebrity Cruises out of Miami googled martial law Arkansas, as did Savannah College of Art and Design. The Navy Network Information Center out of Pensacola, Florida googled fabled enemies. The Oak Ridge National Laboratory out of Knoxville googled SAIC and Chernobyl. Union Pacific Railroad googled magic mushrooms, the secret history. The National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado googled 1936 Olympics weather modification. United Airlines out of Chicago, Googled Flame Protection Squad. Gulf Research and Development Company out of Lebanon, Googled Chicago Tribune, DynCorp Halliburton, Global Slavery Rings. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services out of D.C. Googled Operation Brimstone. The Department of Justice Googled Michael Tesserian on Obama changing campaign logo. APC.Army.mil out of Alexandria Googled Arkansas Crime Wave. The Maryland Procurement Office Googled Operation Brimstone. And finally, the U.S. Department of Transportation out of Chesapeake, Virginia Googled Author Critical, which of course was about Jim Moore, Bush's brain author who's on the terrorist watch list. So let's try and stay off the terrorist watch list together, my friends. That's going to do it for episode 87, August 15th, 2008. It's MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.